Thanks for joining me. I'm John Wells. Homicide cases are tragic, terribly sad events. But then consider cold case homicides, where families have lost a loved one to violence, which is terrible enough, but the case remains open, sometimes forever, and there is never opportunity to turn the final page, to properly grieve, to achieve any kind of closure. I've written about a few of these cold cases for The Spectator over the years. Trisha Roach was one. Her married name was Parischuk. Audrey Gleave, the retired teacher who was murdered out in the country in Ancaster. More recently, I wrote about the case of Joe Mello, which is a homicide that remains unsolved, and it was during that reporting that I heard about Adele. May 15, 1973, Adele Komorowski, 26, a graduate student in German studies at McMaster, became the first person ever murdered on that campus. Accosted by a man outside the Brandon Hall residence and heard screaming as he dragged her into the woods where she was strangled to death. Why was Adele, a popular, intelligent young woman, targeted? And who was her killer? Hamilton police plunged aggressively into the investigation, interviewing friends, colleagues, professors, suspects, witnesses. But this was 1973, and homicide investigators did not have the tools available today. Criminal profiling had not yet been invented, nor had DNA testing. They grilled suspects, old school, even eliciting two false confessions. The suspects included a professor and an older German student and classmate of hers who she had broken off with after they had dated briefly, and then also an infamous serial rapist and spree killer from the US named Robert Garrow. The case remained open, technically, but unsolved for more than four decades. And then in 2012, Adele's only sibling, Peter Komorowski, received a call from a writer in the US named Jim Tracy, who was researching a book about Garrow. Garrow, who had died in 1978, shot trying to escape. The writer told Peter he believed Garrow was Adele's killer, that the circumstances surrounding her death and some of Garrow's other victims were eerily similar. Peter, in turn, having never heard Garrow's name, called Hamilton police. That set in motion a chain of events that ultimately brought veteran Hamilton homicide detective Dave Olenek to the case to reopen the files, explore evidence and suspects. Ultimately, the detective came to conclusions and shared them with Adele's brother. A couple of months after that, I met Peter at his Toronto home. Peter is a reserved, soft-spoken guy. He said that after hearing the detective's presentation and theory on who the killer is, he felt somewhat better, even perhaps feeling a measure of closure, although not 100%. But that, it occurs to me, when it comes to a cold case, is sometimes all one can hope for. I interviewed Dave Olenek for this podcast to get his thoughts about reopening the case and how he came to his conclusions. So I'm joined by Staff Sergeant Dave Olenek, a homicide investigator with the Hamilton Police Service. Dave, thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
So let's go back to how you became involved with this case, the murder of Adele Komorowski. Nearly 5 years ago, in May 2012, there's this author in New York State, his name is Jim Tracy, and he comes up with a theory that Adele was killed by a New York serial rapist and murderer, Robert Garrow, and that in 1973, Garrow had driven across the border to Hamilton and taken Adele as his latest victim. And in the process of the author's research, he contacts Adele's lone sibling, her brother, Peter Komorowski, who was a teenager when Adele was murdered. Peter then contacts Hamilton police. So why did Peter contact police at that point, and what happened from your perspective?
Well, there was there had been an article published in which Jim Tracy had made some conclusions about Robert Garrow, and there was some contact with original investigators, and I'm not sure what took place during the conversation, but the article led one to believe that the case was basically solved, and so Peter reached out to Hamilton Police, because it is unusual for, you know, if we do solve a case or make an arrest or whatever, our practice is to always notify the next of kin before the media or anybody else.
Right.
So, you know, it's naturally curious that something like that would happen. So Peter, of course, called us and to just verify this, you know, mm-hmm. basically here this, apparently this murder's been solved. And is this true?
Right. Which is unusual. I mean, typically family, you know, for a cold case, we'll be waiting sometimes for years or whatever
right.
for something to come from police. And not typically they would read something in the media that's been solved.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, when we have a fresh case now, I always tell the family that I always assure them is that we will do everything in our power to make sure that they find out any news from us directly and not through the media. Mm-hmm. So if we arrest somebody, we arrest them and then call the family and then do, you know, any kind of media release, that kind of thing, so right. that they're not blindsided.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're called in by your supervisors, kind of thing, and what happens?
Yeah, so at that time I was a detective, and it was Staff Sergeant Dave Beach who was contacted. So there was a file. There was a very small file, just kind of in the lockers at the back of the office. We pulled that out, and there were some articles there. And we arranged to have coffee with Peter and his wife, mm-hmm. and just talked in general terms. And then we the actual boxes, there was a few banker's boxes full of you know, all the actual case material that was stored off site, and that was requested, and we just started going through all the original reports.
And so the boxes, I mean, I've seen in years past, I've seen, you know, boxes that are associated with certain cases, kind of thing. And in this day and age, there'll be just stacks of banker's boxes for a homicide case.
Right.
This was 1973. Were there fewer boxes back then than there would be today for a homicide case?
Yeah, there was only two or three. There was two with filled with documents, and then there was one with some exhibits in it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
and we'll get into some of the specifics of the case, but in terms of forensics, Adele had been strangled in the course of the murder. So in terms of forensics that were in the boxes or what have you, what was there?
The rope itself, that was pretty much it as far as direct exhibits. There was some other samples taken, but they were not really that pertinent.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's go back to that night when Adele was murdered outside Brandon Hall at McMaster.
Right.
And the specifics of what witnesses saw and heard. Give us the general outline of what happened to her that night.
So it was May of 1973. So regular classes were you know, finished for the year. So the campus was a lot emptier than usual. But there were graduate students on the campus. There was a conference being held. So there was still activity on the campus, but it was not as populous as it usually would be during the regular school year. So Adele was working in her office, and at just after 11 o'clock that night, she'd left her work and was walking towards Brandon Hall. A witness looked down, witness looked down from the sixth floor and could see that Adele, or she could just see a female being approached by a male and being grabbed by the arm. And she could hear the woman say something like, "Leave me alone." And later the witness described this a little more fully as it looked like a somebody that was familiar to her. There was no, it was not like a blitz attack. She was just kind of initially just approached, but then she was pulled out of sight from the witness into the darkened area beside Brandon Hall. And that's when the witness heard more of a yell and just sounds like a scuffle or an assault.
It's a wooded, I've been out there with you. And this trail that goes behind the residence, it's going towards sort of Coots Paradise. Is it not?
Brandon Hall's like right at the very edge of the campus.
Right.
So yeah, it drops off right away.
It's a heavy wooded area and a pretty steep trail.
Yeah. And there's trails all through there, but it's pretty dark and there is no more buildings after that.
Right.
Yeah. So the witness ran downstairs. She tried the phone for whatever reason. It didn't work. She ran downstairs, and at that time there was like a night duty person in the lobby of Brandon Hall. And by the time she got there, there was other people that had been alerted in the area, and McMaster security was already called. So a search of the area, an ad hoc search, started almost right away. And within a few minutes, McMaster security responded. And as the witness had indicated, the direction of away from Brandon Hall led directly to a path into the ravine. So that led them to search that immediate area. And within about 15 or 20 minutes, they found Adele, and she was already dead.
And she was found. She was on her back on the slope of the trail. And she'd been strangled. What was the? How was she found in terms of this rope? It's pretty ghastly and unusual, at least to my ears.
Yeah, I mean she was found. Her arms were, or her wrists were tied behind her back and around her neck. Her top had been removed, and her pants were partially down. However, it looked like she had been dragged, and that perhaps her pants had been partially removed as a result of being dragged a bit.
Right.
She was found off the trail. I can't say exactly how far off the trail, but it wasn't. It didn't take that long for them to find her. So. We're aware of the general area where the crime scene was at the time.
Yeah, and she had a cloth,
J cloth, yes,
stuffed in her mouth.
Yes.
What's your theory on the purpose of the J cloth? Is that so she wouldn't make noise, or?
That's what it would look like. Yes. Yeah.
and I'm struck by, I mean, you know, in terms of that timeline you talk about. I mean, the witness sees her being sort of led away, and then, you know, clearly forced away at some point there and dragged away, and within a pretty short period of time, the killer ties her with these ropes and does all this within minutes, or like quite quickly, I guess, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, as we talked, we went out to the scene. You can see from down the trail, Brandon Hall's quite visible.
Yes.
There's the lamps near the entrance of the hall, which hasn't really changed much in all these years. And there's an indication that McMaster security, when they arrived in their cruiser, actually left the roof lights going as well. All that, from where Adele was found, would have been visible to the killer.
Right.
And that's what leads me to believe that she was killed outright, and it was staged to look more like that it was a sexual nature. That there was no, it clearly was an assault sexual nature, the fact that her top was removed. However, I believe it was staged to look more like it was And a rape that had been interrupted, sort of thing, more of as a way for the killer to make it look like perhaps it was a random assault of a of a sexual nature, and not a purposeful killing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which is interesting. We'll get into why that's interesting in terms of if that was the killer's intent to make it look random. And also, we'll also return to that the aspect, which I find interesting, that the witness described that initial encounter between Adele and this man who killed her as being one where she didn't seem to be taken aback by him at first, in terms of that it seemed like she knew him.
Right.
As opposed to a stranger all of a sudden rushing her from the parking lot and taking her away.
Right.
Yeah. But we'll talk more about that. That's a key point. So at this point in the investigation, police are on the scene, and they, as with homicide back then, it's all hands on deck. Everyone's plunging in the investigation
right.
in the early hours. They have different tools at their disposal than now, but they're all on board and going to this hard. And they throw the net over everyone Adele might have been in touch with, anyone seen in the area. So in general terms, in terms of whatever you can tell us, in terms of the local suspects, who'd you see emerging in the case file as being potential local suspects in the early days of the investigation?
Well, as with today, I mean, you have to keep an open mind in any investigation, and they, quickly tried to establish this. Just a background. Who was Adele, and who would have had an interest in killing her? Mm. Was it random? Was it a stranger, or who had relationships with her? She was a young single woman, and who was dating or had been dating. She was recently engaged to an officer in Germany. She had just returned from Germany. And after an extended period, basically as part of her studies. And not everybody knew that she had become engaged while over in Germany. So that was a fairly new thing. Mm. But she is, as a student, I mean, she did form, relationships and friendships with other people in the area. So of course they tried to track down as many people who knew something about Adele and what her habits would have been, who knew her, who would have, been able to comment on what her, her habits were, and again, what potential motive would be out there.
Right. Another suspect comes onto the radar for police from further afield, a man in the U.S., Robert Garrow.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about how Garrow shows up in the police investigation documents that you reviewed.
Yes. So that was another thing that when Peter first approached us, the local article written about Garrow was that it was presented as if this was fresh information. And in going through the box, it was evident that they'd already considered him at the time. What had happened was, over the course of that summer, so this happened in the middle of May, over the course of the summer, the investigators reached out to neighboring jurisdictions and Interpol, looking for any possible suspects, links, information, that kind of thing. Not unlike what we do today with various bulletins to neighboring agencies and things like that. So the New York State Police responded that they had, this was, forgive me on the exact timelines, but August, that they had just dealt with Robert Garrow. He'd been a serial offender in New York State for some time, and he'd been arrested for other offenses in the past, and he had recently been arrested for a murder in relation to some campers in the Adirondacks. And that they suggested him as a part of as a potential suspect. So I can't say as to what the details were. Again, I don't have all of the, it's quite evident from the file that there's some things that have been missing over the years. But we have correspondence basically from the chief of Hamilton Police to one of the senior officers of New York State Police saying that, let's just make sure that the investigators talk firsthand about this. So there was just correspondence back and forth saying, this is the name of our investigator, this is the name of your investigator. We're going to have them talk and they can sort it out firsthand. And it would seem that they did so. Mm-hmm. But there's no written account of whatever conversation they would have had.
And some of the points back at the time being raised and that were raised by the author in New York State who wrote or is writing a book on Garrow was that there were some notes in a file that indicated that at some point Garrow had a map on him where he had circled Hamilton. On this map that he had drawn, there were notes to that effect that he had done that at some point. And there was evidence he had crossed the border at the Peace Bridge at some point in the recent past, I guess.
Well, there was there's notes about a map. We don't have the map, mm-hmm. and nobody's seen the map in years. We don't know what happened to it. It was in the possession of New York State Police. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of discrepancy as to what exactly was on there, because the article that drew local attention talked about there being basically a connect the dots, that there was red dots in all these potential target cities where Robert Garrow's victims were. And yet the report written by New York State Police at the time indicated that there were circles and squares, and then over the city of Hamilton, there was a question mark.
Oh, okay. Question.
So, it just leaves it open to interpretation. First off, it's less definite that it's a, connect the dots, so to speak. The other thing is, what is the actual symbol of these, what do these actual symbols mean? And the other thing is that all of these other symbols apparently were around towns in Garrow's home turf of New York State. So this question mark over the city of Hamilton, is that more of like a note in the margin or, off to the side?
Right.
I mean, we don't know. We could speculate and draw conclusions one way or the other. And I'm not, I can't 100% close the door on that, but ultimately nobody's seen this. As far as the Peace Bridge, apparently there is indication that he had been, at some point in his life, he had been into Canada across the Peace Bridge. Right. There was no indication of time frame that I could see, and there was none indicated. In and of itself, residents of Ontario, New York, across the Peace Bridge, I don't know, innumerable times,
yes,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's just a... It's a open border, and we all go back and forth,
right?
Throughout the course of our lives. So, if a specific time frame was indicated, that would be useful, but there wasn't one.
And I thought you mentioned when we chatted earlier that I found an interesting point that Garrow, when he was tried for one of his offenses, or I'm not sure where when it happened in the county, Hamilton County, New York State.
Yes.
I find that to be interesting as well, that, the association with Hamilton could be related to that, but who knows?
Yeah.
So, at this stage in the investigation, then they're looking at Garrow, at mm-hmm. least he's been floated out there. They're also focusing somewhat on this, ex-boyfriend, of Adele's.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about him and his background. He was from Germany as well.
Yes, he was from Germany. Adele was a graduate student in languages in German, so that is why she seemed to have these colleagues or associations with people of who spoke German or German descent or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that was because that was her focus of studies as well. And as I said, she'd been back and forth to Germany. For that reason as well. So, he'd been born in Germany and came over as a young adult and joined the German Navy, or the, sorry, the Canadian Navy, and got out of the Navy and traveled the countryside kind of as a kind of rootless perpetual student. He attended several universities across the country, some out west. He was in Winnipeg for a while, and he ended up back in Hamilton. He'd been back to Germany recently before that and had just returned to Hamilton as well. And he had been seen by strangers and those close to Adele in Adele's company. There had been some reports of Adele being in a heated argument with a male the day before her murder. And then somebody else remarked that they had seen her in the cafeteria, that he had stopped by and exchanged words with her while she was having coffee earlier the day of the murder as well. And there was also an indication that he'd been in the building where Adele had been working late that night. Mm-hmm. She had remarked, I think the term boyfriend is a bit of a stretch in the sense that she had remarked to others that they had briefly dated, but Adele apparently said that he was too quote unquote high and mighty.
Right.
And again, we go into speculation now, but it is possible that he still had some feelings for Adele, and that he had just found out that she had become engaged to another person.
Right. Right. Yeah. You know, the attitude, the high and mighty attitude is interesting. I mentioned to you how I interviewed someone who knew Adele back at the time, and she also knew of this guy who I'm referring to as the ex-boyfriend, just for identification. But and she talked about the same thing, that, I mean, she told me that he seemed to have an Aryan sense of superiority that to him is in terms of the attitude. But that's, I guess, obviously that's something that's part of the mix.
Yeah, and that was in his records in the Navy as well, that he was generally a good sailor, but that he had a bit of a superior, arrogant tone towards his fellow workers.
Right.
So that was seems to be a theme in his behavior.
And the rope, the tying of the knots, and him being in the Navy, did you thought that might also be a factor?
Yeah, well, it definitely is a factor. Mm-hmm. The fact that you know, he would be that much more familiar with tying knots and things like that. Yeah.
Right. Returning to Garrow now. So Robert Garrow, to your mind, I mean, he was a natural suspect in one respect, at least, that he had been on this reign of terror of some of sorts in the U.S., raping and killing women. Mm-hmm. That's why, you know, New York State Police was in touch with Hamilton in the first place. And there's other sort of these other mysterious sort of points we talked about that may or may not have any significance. But what to you about Garrow specifically in terms of him and your reading of the case files and so on suggests that he was not Adele's killer?
Okay. Well, I'm not an expert on Robert Garrow, but I've done a bit of reading as a result of this. But right off the top, he does not match the description. Robert Garrow was 5'11", 200 pounds, 210 pounds, I believe, bald, glasses. Indications were from the letter from New York State Police was he was very self-conscious of being bald and liked to wear a hat. The witness to the encounter between the suspect and Adele said that the suspect was much taller than Adele. Mm-hmm. And this ex-boyfriend that we've just been talking about was 6'3".
Right.
And matches the description given by the witnesses. In addition to other things, again, I'm not an expert on Robert Garrow, and so I don't really want to get into too much of a debate about his dealings, but the general MO is just different. And we See, in general terms, Garrow seemed to prefer somewhat familiar territory. You know, his crimes were, limited to his home territory of upstate and western New York. Mm-hmm. You know, that was his turf, so to speak. He would sexually assault younger women, and sometimes he would let them go. Sometimes he would abduct them. All of his killings, and this was at the time by the New York State Police, were stabbings. He also, the thing with the rope was that his most latest victim was some campers in New York State that he snuck up on, and the tying up, he tied them up and stabbed one of the males. So it just, the overall MO doesn't seem to fit in that his primary motive, first of all, the stabbing, killers do tend to keep to one kind of method of choice in general. Again, there's no 100%, but mm-hmm. in general. And the other thing is, too, is that Garrow, when attacking females, seemed to do so for sexual gratification. And again, there is no evidence that, other than the removal of her top, that Adele was sexually assaulted in any way or even attempted to be sexually assaulted, that it all just appeared staged. That's just not something Robert Garrow would have done. The map, we could argue about, again, it's open to interpretation, bottom line is we don't have it. The other thing is that the investigators, the first-hand investigators at the time, corresponded and ruled him out.
Right.
I think that says a lot right there as well.
Right.
The fact that we have this arrogant male who would appear was jilted or rejected by Adele fairly recently, was seen in a couple of confrontations with them within the previous 2 days. He matches the description. He is familiar with the area because he's a graduate student at Mac as well. When he approaches or is approached by police, he admits to having been out for a hike in Coots Paradise that night as well. The investigators at the time, and it does seem to be true, that they felt that he was placing himself in the area almost as a preemptive challenge, just in case anybody did see him, saying that, yes, he was out for a walk that night in the area, but that he had nothing to do with it and that he was back home by the time of the murder. He also said that he had been stopped by a uniformed police officer on Main Street at the time of the murder, and that just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. All the patrol officers in the area were canvassed, and that encounter did not occur. He had said to, before the police even had questioned him, he had mentioned to a couple of friends that the police were after him. He had a bit of a breakdown. He'd had a few drinks, and he had a bit of a breakdown at one friend's house, saying that the police were after him. And one day he would be able to tell the truth about the matter, words to that effect. I forget exactly what he said. But he was very agitated, and it would appear that he considered himself a suspect before he had even been approached by the police. Mm-hmm. Again, this arrogance, this arrogant attitude came through in all the witnesses. So, I mean, he was interrogated. He agreed to take a polygraph test, and then a lawyer contacted the police and said he will not be taking a polygraph test. Hmm. That in and of itself, no lawyer would ever let a client take a polygraph right. test. I mean, it's been right. my experience that that just doesn't happen anyway, that any lawyer would probably intervene, that, mm-hmm. That he wouldn't voluntarily submit to that. So it's a little bit, but not much. But it is, but on his, when confronted, he declined any further cooperation with the police. The one thing also about Garrow is that there was conclusions drawn about the fact that he had a Volkswagen, and a Volkswagen was seen speeding away from the area at the time. Again, this is a bit of a conjecture in the sense that there was a report by neighbors that there was a Volkswagen, a green Volkswagen, seen speeding away from down a street blocks and blocks away from the scene. As we've seen in the scene, there are no roadways near the scene.
No, that's right.
To make that connection is a bit of a stretch. The other thing is, too, is that Robert Garrow had an orange Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. Everybody had Volkswagens back then.
Right.
You know,
right.
This is a student campus in the early 70s.
Yeah.
The professor who would come up as a person of interest had a Volkswagen. Adele had a Volkswagen. I'm going to suggest that McMaster campus was littered with the little Volkswagen bugs that everybody was driving back
right.
then. Yeah.
Right. You're going through all the interviews and the files and the boxes and speaking with some of the investigators from back in the day who were since retired and that sort of thing. Clearly, and I've written about cold cases from back in the '70s before. Clearly, the officers were going at it hard, interviewing people aggressively. They're going after the case hard. But there are limitations back then when compared to a homicide investigation today.
Right.
You said to me that, if this murder had happened today, you would have had more tools at your disposal, correct?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And there's no, as I've said in my final report, there's no room to criticize the investigation at that time. They did a great job, and they put a lot of effort into this with the tools that they had. For instance, DNA technology, that would have been science fiction back in their day. Mm-hmm. They never even would have dreamed of that. They had,
right.
They had blood typing, which would potentially rule in or out a certain faction of the population, but that's it,
Right.
It's outside, so fingerprints are, pretty much, non-existent in that kind of environment. And, there weren't as many security cameras, cell phone towers collecting data of people in the area, all of those things that they did not have at their disposal that mm-hmm. we do.
Right.
Just interviewing techniques, profiling techniques, things that they just, again, did not have at their disposal. Mm-hmm. Cultural awareness, the way of all that we've learned and we're trained about domestic violence and how the end of a relationship is the most high risk period for violence or homicide in a domestic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So which definitely, again, fits with what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure I've hopped, skipped, and jumped over quite a few bits there because there was a vast amount of interviews, and I'm just touching on some highlights. But we just would have that much more at our disposal now, just resources in general.
Mm-hmm.
We have a dedicated homicide unit. When I first looked at this, we wanted to kind of have a somewhat of a clean approach without prejudice. So I purposely did not reach out to the original investigators at first,
right.
just to read through it and absorb it on my own. And it was Dave Beach and I originally, and then Dave was transferred. And so then I brought Detective Andrew Coughlin on, and he helped me review it as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we went through this independently. I had asked Detective Coughlin to just look at it. I didn't suggest anything to him either.
Right.
He came to the same conclusions.
Mm.
When eventually we felt that we had obtained our own opinion, I talked to retired Superintendent Clive Pauls, who had been one of the original investigators, and he concurred with the conclusions that we had made. And I recently spoke with retired detective Jim Willis as well, and he agreed as well. And concurs with the conclusions that we made as well.
And so in the end, your conclusion that you came to from this process was that Adele's killer was who?
The ex-boyfriend. And we'll just call him that because it's a term that we can use.
Right.
There were several persons of interest in Adele's life. that were looked at. There was a couple of red herrings early on, as what happens, and they were run down to the end of those alleys until they were concluded. She did have, she was a single woman, and she'd been dating different men. So people that she'd been, had been dating over the previous year or so were all talked to. One boyfriend in particular, he on the surface looked like possible because it turned out, he had left the area. It appeared on the surface that he left abruptly left town abruptly mm-hmm. within a few days of the murder. But then again, looking into his background, talking to family members and his new job, it turned out that he had applied for this job out of province months before. Mm-hmm. And it was just completely coincidence that he had finally secured this job and that it had been prearranged that he was going to move on that date. Right. So that was really a non-starter. And when I mentioned that to Peter Komorowski, actually, he was actually grateful because he had mentioned to me that he remembered him and he thought he was a really nice guy. And he was glad that we didn't think it was him because it would have kind of tainted his memory of him because mm-hmm. he remembered that he was, that he liked him.
Right.
There was another, I think you mentioned a professor that she had dated. Yeah, he was ruled out as well. And again, there was a few other names that came up briefly and interviews were conducted and alibis checked and they were all just ruled out. So now we're at the point where we're reviewing the case and the professor has died some years ago. So we no longer can talk to him to kind of double check anything there. And this ex-boyfriend, we were able to track him down, and he had returned to Germany in 1975 and died in Germany in 2005 with never married, no known relatives or children.
There will never be a conviction in this case. These people of interest, the prime suspect is dead. There's no DNA evidence that could, positively identify, the killer.
Right.
So is it a technical matter? Is it case closed?
Well, it's concluded in the sense that there is, short of somebody coming forward with completely fresh information, there's nothing more to be done. Who we believe to be the suspect, the primary suspect, is dead. Mm-hmm. Robert Garrow, who I do not believe is the suspect, however, he cannot be 100% ruled out. He's also dead. He was killed in 1978, I believe, during an escape attempt from prison in New York State. Mm-hmm. And we said this to the family, and as I've mentioned in my final report, in conclusion, there is no definitive conclusion. It is open-ended, however, with the passage of time and the fact that, a few of the people that possibly were suspects are now dead, there really is, there is nothing else that could be done short of somebody coming in and basically confessing to this.
In your own personal opinion, in terms of, percentage, what percent positive are you personally that ex-boyfriend, as we've talked about, is the killer?
I personally believe wholeheartedly that he is. However, as an investigator, I would professionally be obligated to keep an open mind and be open to, some inconvenient truth, as they say, right?
Right.
So, but I personally believe that he was responsible.
Now, you've been careful not to tell me during the podcast or during our interviews the name of the ex-boyfriend, even though he is deceased and as you said, has no surviving family that you're aware of. He never had any children because as a technical matter, he was never charged with anything. He's long dead. There's no legal issue certainly, but is it an ethical one of sorts in terms of why you prefer not to volunteer the name?
Well, I think I mean, everybody deserves their day in court. Everybody has an, you know, an opportunity to answer to any charge. And I think, you know, we're not really in a position to release a name unless somebody's been formally charged. If somebody's alive, you know, we don't release the name until the information is actually sworn to in court. And we're just abiding by that rule. Again, I've given my opinion that this person is responsible, but it is not a conviction. There is, you know, it has not been tested in court. So for that matter, you know, Hamilton Police will not formally release his name. The family, Peter Komorowski, they know the name because they know the people in, they knew the people in Adele's life. Mm-hmm. So they obviously knew a lot of the personalities that we were talking about anyway. Right. So.
Right. And I have, you know, certainly through other people I've interviewed for the story over the last couple of months, found that the name of this ex-boyfriend, originally from Germany, was a man named Alfred Petzold, which is a German name. He was 38, Petzold, and he returned to Germany 2 years after the murder, and as we said, died in 2005 at age 70 with no known relatives.
Well, you can draw your own conclusion as to his identity, but yeah, we won't be formally giving his name.
So let me conclude with this, Dave, to ask you a little bit. You mentioned, I suppose, the final stage of this process for you, this investigation, was to go and see Peter Komorowski, Adele's only sibling, her brother, and talk a bit about that. I gather you presented your findings to him, and to talk a bit about that meeting and how he reacted to what you were telling him about all this, all these many, you know, decades later since his sister was brutally murdered.
Yeah, well, initially, when he reached out to us, he, you know, he said at the time of the murder, I believe he said, I think he was 15 at the time, and his dad had been, you know, obviously quite upset and never really talked that much about it. And he remembers, you know, police officers coming to and fro and that kind of thing, but he never really knew the details. He was happy to be able to, to know more about the case and what actually happened. I shouldn't say happy, but he was glad to be able to find out exactly what had happened. And he said to me that he feels that he has a little bit of closure now as to this conclusion, even though it is kind of a tentative conclusion.
What does it mean to you as an investigator, and you know, from interviewing you, I mean, you know, you're a father here in Hamilton, and what does it mean to you to bring that information to Peter? You know, as I say, you know, decades later, this is something he's had to live with, and to essentially close the lid on the case. And in terms of Adele's memory, this woman who, by all accounts, was this dynamic, intelligent, beautiful young woman. What did it mean to you to be able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, it's satisfying in any investigation to bring it to a conclusion. As I said, it's somewhat, you know, tentative conclusion. But it's, I was gratified to be able to do that for the family. Because at the end of the day now, there will be no test in court. So really, it is... I mean, obviously, it's a matter of public safety as well to, you know, we have been able to reach a conclusion that we are pretty satisfied that there was no, you know, this was not part of a random killer's spree, so to speak, that this was an isolated event, so that there was no other public safety matter, although there were other unsolved murders at the time. We believe that this was an isolated event. And but it was good to be able to provide some that sense of closure to the family.
And finally, you know, I'm sure in this day and age, even when suspects are convicted in court of murder, there will always be voices out there and people who question the verdict and so on. And so certainly with a case like this where there was no conviction and no trial, there will be some who will contest your finding on this, and who might even believe the killer is still out there. And, Garrow certainly is dead as one of the other suspects, but I suppose that's just the reality of a case like this, that there will always be speculation that could exist out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's because there is no really definitive conclusion. It is open-ended. Mm-hmm. I can't say 100%. Although I have my opinion, I can't. Yeah, it has not been tested in court and really never will be. Mm-hmm. People are free to speculate as they wish. That's the end of the road as far as we're concerned right now. Yeah.
Dave, thanks for your time on this.
Well, thank you.